Right, so while we're waiting for the first questions to come up, I actually have a few of my own that I wanted to ask. I was going to start with John, actually. So I mentioned in the introduction, obviously there's many different metrics you might use for purchasing reinsurance, and you touched on quite a lot on the capital piece, also on the expected recoveries, etc. Typically, what are the main metrics you see insurers articulating in terms of their motives for buying reinsurance?
Yeah, I think at a really basic level, the main one is to make sure it's APRA compliant. From a capital perspective, and as Andrew touched on, you know, boards are massively focused on making sure that everything is APRA approved. So I think the first question that we get as Aon Benfield is, okay, how does that structure comply with APRA? You know, it looks like it's got a bit of a wrinkle there. Is it APRA compliant? And then the second point is, well, okay, it's very well that I've got that structure in place, but it's actually, what is it going to do for my earnings? And I touched on it in my presentation, the sort of balance between spending money because you have to have this sort of capital protection versus spending money that you'd like to get most of it back. And to me, that's you know, there's all different ways to spin it, but they're the two key dynamics that people are really focusing on.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Oh, I have a question at the front here.
Coming.
Almost.
How ready are boards of Australian insurers for cat bonds? And understanding them and selling them.
I'd probably only see one board or yeah. Seen a couple of boards, but my initial answer is, I mean, as I think many boards are only just getting across cat modelling, I mean, cat bonds is probably another step out there, but I mean, I think once they get the cat modelling quite well, they'll start to get the cat bonds happening, but it would be a challenge for them. But the risks need to be spelled out to them, that's for sure.
I think you're seeing a real, yeah, if you look at the absolute simplest form, the investors would be quite happy just to have one metric and either the Sydney earthquake happens or it doesn't happen. But the investors have learnt that if they do that, no one will ever buy the cover. So what you're starting to see is this: the investment market's moving more towards traditional reinsurance. And you've got various vehicles that are effectively writing UNL, ultimate net loss, so that gets rid of the basis risk. They're willing to do reinstatements, they're willing to do all perils. Now, as you move towards that, if you go towards all perils, there's a challenge there, and there's modelling challenges. So you are starting to see, I think cat bonds represent a big challenge for various reasons that Andrew outlined, but I think you need to be careful about thinking, and not helped by my presentation, dividing the world into traditional and alternate. You are starting to see. So
it's all grey, there's no doubt.
There is a lot of grey, and we're in the middle of renewal at the moment. You'll talk to a reinsurer, and the reinsurer says, we can do more capacity, we're going to get it from our third-party investors. So the client doesn't actually see anything different. There is also a lot of capacity in the Australian market that is fronted. So the Suncorp would have some arrangements, Andrew would look down the list, and it would be Hanover Re. But that part of Hanover Re is actually acting as a front of the collateralised market and picking up the reinstatement and picking up some of the differences in terms. So you're really starting to see a grey area, and I think that's both ways. I think the regulators are starting to move a little bit, but the investors are starting to realise you can't actually sell a product unless it meets people's needs. So you are starting to see a bit of a transition. Yeah. Maybe.
And I totally agree. I think my other question would be that, yeah, you know, tight spot on. People tend to look at it as black and white. And I would argue that even if a cat bond doesn't tick off all the APRA metrics or there's a little bit of risk, if you thought it was capital efficient, why wouldn't you do it? And then as a board, you then just have to explain that there's a little bit of a gap and you might be taking some basis risk or your ICRC is a little bit higher because of that. But I think people get too sort of locked into, okay, well, that's not quite APRA approved, and I can't explain that gap, so I won't go down that path. And to me, it's that willingness to be flexible.
If Suncorp put a single shot, Sydney earthquake only, $500 million cap bond above their reinsurance program, they'd get no APRA capital relief, but Suncorp would be, albeit at the margins, a more secure company than what if it hadn't purchased it. Mm. So you've got to be a little bit careful how much is done for it. And the flip side, with the Lagic covers, you're buying fourth event covers. John talked about earnings volatility capital. But you almost end up buying reinsurance purely to give you APRA capital relief. Yeah. He doesn't have much other economic. He's 10x 10 fourth event. You're only paying that to get APRA capital relief. It's actually probably not doing that much for your earnings volatility or your economic capital. So it comes back to why you're buying it.
And I'd actually like to add to that as well. I mean, certainly in terms of your view of your economic capital needs, and when you're setting capital targets in your ICAP, certainly you do look at regulatory capital, but that's not at all the only thing you're looking at. You're looking at many other different views. And you may find that, for example, buying that fourth cover, it may well reduce your PCR, but it might not actually make barely any impact at all on your view of your economic capital needs. Mm. So you may still actually choose to hold the same amount of capital, regardless of whether that yep. covers in place or not. So that would erode some of that perceived benefit of the yep. of the fourth cover.
Totally.
Cool. Okay, we have a question that's come through on the SMS. How does the AA balance contributing to decisions on cat reinsurance purchases and then reviewing these decisions mm-hmm. as required in the FCR?
How do I balance it? I suppose the approach I take at the moment is I'm not responsible for setting those limits. So I'm actually providing an advisory role in terms of here's the modelling output, here's what we think the numbers are. And if there's then a different number, I might come up with a number. There may well then be a discussion around some of the assumptions that I've made or my team have made in terms of pulling that information together. And there's then a debate on those discussions. But the actual final call as to who is, you know, what are the assumptions that are going to be made for setting that limit and how that actually gets there is going to be something that's going to be made by management, by people responsible for the reinsurance placement, which is ultimately, in my case, the commercial insurance CEO. So I suppose I tend to be involved in the discussion, but as with most models and as with most assumptions, there's obviously a range of uncertainty there, and it's coming down to whether the assumptions that they take are a reasonable set of assumptions. That's probably the best way I can describe it, because I'm not the one setting that number. The number's going to be set ultimately by the board, but actually recommended by the management.
Okay, and we'll move on to the question that I asked half of already.
Hi, Andy.
Do you see a role for super funds as reliable capital partners in reinsurance?
Yes. Like, I think what you see is when a superannuation fund decides to go into an investment class, they don't do it themselves. They give it to another provider. So you have these various different insurance-linked funds set up, and if I was a superannuation trustee, we'd decide to put some money in there. Now, the sustainability is a different question. Trustees will change their mind, decide to have more or less in different asset classes, but these funds are sitting there getting the funds from different things. So some of these big Bermudan ILS funds have got money from Ottawa teachers' pensions and various different things. The challenge they have is your traditional reinsurer has a capital base that grows with earnings and up and down, whereas they rely a little bit on investors. And you go to Bermuda and you talk to some of these funds and they're sort of saying, oh, we've had some new money come in. And they're trying to then find a home for it. Or they've got people who want to withdraw their money. But I think as an asset class, it's no different to sort of saying, you know, some of these green funds. You know, there's vehicles set up for the superannuation funds to invest into. So I think the capital is quite reliable and I think superannuation is long term.
Okay.
We
have a question on the floor.
Oh, Andy, Tim Clark from IAG. We've come a long way with risk appetite and risk appetite statements, and we've heard a lot today about the difficulty, the uncertainty around, uncertainty is probably the word that's been mentioned the most, the uncertainty around the cap modelling output and everything. Now, there's expectations that risk appetite statements can both quantify where you're going to buy to, the one in 250, the one in 200, whatever, and some measure of uncertainty around that. Now, we have discussions with our board about the uncertainty, but actually trying to articulate it in words that can communicate further down the organisation about what we're going to buy through that risk appetite statement. I guess, Ty, you're probably giving a lot of advice to clients on this. Have you come across this and been able to solve this one?
we have this great process. We have the flow chart, you know, understand the client's objectives, you know, get the data, gross losses, model the reinsurance, put it back to the objective, and it works brilliantly, and then you go and place it. The only problem we often have is no one can articulate what the objective was right at the first step. So you're back into John's K, the constant. I think the other bit too is understanding the different levels of the company, and you're seeing, you know, and take your organisation, Tim, you know, actually buying as one entity. You know, so your conversations vary depending on whether you're talking to someone in a group role versus the individual business units. You've seen QBE buy more centrally, you've seen Allianz globally buy more centrally. So it's working out who's making those decisions and what their objectives are at the different levels as they filter down. And the good organisations filter their objectives down. So if you're running IAG, Tim, and I'm sitting there writing a little book of, you know, SME property, I end up with a set of objectives that I just have to worry about. You know, I'm not there buying my own reinsurance, doing my own thing, but yeah, these big organisations, it's a challenge to get to filter it down. I think it's also a challenge to articulate the objective in the first place. Is it a absolute insolvency objective? Is it an APRA insolvency objective? And I always find risk appetite, there's two types of risk appetite. There's risk appetite before the event and risk appetite after the event. And that's always an interesting, post claims is always an interesting experience. So.
Okay, we have a question at the back, Rick.
It's a saw. Ty?
Yeah.
How you going?
Yep.
It was interesting to think of how we've expected ILSs to continue growing as you sort of discussed. But then we've also aware that since Katrina, at least, since 06, we've had probably excess capacity in the reinsurance market. So I just wonder if that growth that we see in ILSs in the tail, which what we're talking about, maybe it's just not there. Maybe the reinsurance market in the world is already capitalised to an extent that doesn't allow for that future growth.
Yeah, we've seen a massive tightening in spreads, which is sort of effectively the premium of a cat bond, and it's purely because of the appetite there. And so you're actually seeing back to supply and demand. So you sort of want, yeah, I think your question is, you know, how big can it get? Yeah. The margins have come right down purely because of the supply. I think the other challenge is, does it go the way, do we end up, and this is just thinking aloud, do we end up like the CDSs with some of these products where there was way more of them ever sold than the original product? You know, do you end up just trading this risk, and the investment banks create this thing where you can buy and sell and go long and short on all this cat rate, which seems to, and I'm not an expert, seems to happen in the credit market. You know, there was way more derivatives traded than there were on the original product.
Maybe the cycle maybe has flattened a bit. Maybe if we'd had another Katrina or even another World Trade Center, maybe we wouldn't get the hardening that we saw in those events just because of the capacities is there.
Yeah, but what's interesting is every time the cycle turns, everyone sort of says that's the end of the cycle. And those cycles just keep going. I think what's really interesting is, you know, with a lot of things, whether it's equities, whether it's homeowners warranty, whether it's reinsurance, you can make money over the cycle as long as you don't miss the two best years. And you've had, you know, speaking of my job with the 2014 renewal, we've got all these reinsurers knocking on our door. They're coming back into Australia. They had a bad year in 2011. They pulled out for 2012 and 2013 when the rates were going up. And now they've seen it and they're piling back in and they've managed to miss the bet. So there's a fair bit of illogic. I think you're trying to be a bit logical there, Rick. I think there's a fair bit of knee-jerk reaction. It's almost like my risk appetite question. You can sit there and go 10,000 simulations and work out the perfect retention is $373 million. But when the event happens and someone loses the 370, someone says, who the hell did this and why aren't we buying excess of 50? At higher prices, you know? So, it'd be interesting to see. Post-event will be very interesting.
We have a question down at the front here.
Just another question. Going back to looking at it from an investor's perspective, and so the North American pension funds are looking for 6% return, mainly because they're benchmarking against bonds, which are their alternative investments. And as capital starts to move that way and that supply increases, well, what are going to be the implications for return on equity for the traditional reinsurers? And, you know, if there's capital out there going at 6%, I mean, are we still, as an investor, should I still be looking for 13% on equity? And how long is that gap going to stay there? Because it doesn't seem logical in the long run.
Yeah, and I'm not the expert on the overall, you know, what's an appropriate return on equity. I think if you're a reinsurer, different reinsurers used to traditionally buy retro from other reinsurers. I think the opportunity there, and you see it, you know, great big balance sheets like Swiss Re and Munich Re are actually seeding some of this risk into this market, and then you're almost in John's world of arbitrage. Yeah. So do they end up with a lower net balance sheet, buy back some shares and actually have smaller balance sheets and actually almost bring all the risk in and then slice and dice, and they almost become the facilitator for some of these cat bonds out the back. Whether the number is 10%, 12%, 15%, I don't know. I think the fact that insurers and reinsurers change their targets so often, I think there are we used to be 1,000 basis points above risk-free at some point at Swiss, and then we're 12%. So I think they're having trouble finding it, but I think the reinsurers will get a lot smarter in how they actually use this for themselves.
Cool. I'm going to try and squeeze two more quick questions in. I've got some on the screen,
for
so I just want to do...
For someone else.
Yep. There are a few questions on the screen, so just want to give
you love it.
I think Jürgen's got one.
Okay, one more from the floor, and then we'll take two very quickly from the screen.
Thank you, Andy. It's Jürgen Hoffman from APRA. I may let you go, actually, because you might actually pick up the question that I sent you there.
I'm getting quite
anxious because time's running out and you haven't asked my question. So I thought I'll break the microphone. So which
number
one?
Number two on the list.
Do you want to read it?
Which one? We've got three on there at the moment.
I'm guessing the second one.
It's the one that starts for AH. So Andrew prompted the question, but anyone can answer.
Oh. What do boards really understand in the short time they have?
No, that couldn't be an APRA question. Absolutely not.
Okay. What should AAs be doing to help boards ask the right questions about CAT models?
No. Third one lucky.
That's all that's on screen.
That's all. Well, I don't know what's happened then. Okay, let me ask.
There's some screening going on in the background. They are filtered.
It's the S. I've double checked the SMS number.
But they
right
have your number, Jürgen.
Sorry.
They know it's coming
now.
From
it's
you.
On screen.
Here we go.
Oh,
okay.
Damn.
Here we
so
go.
It's been, okay, hijacked. Okay, I can understand.
Your grammar is terrible.
inappropriate time. Use of capitalisation, perhaps, as well, huh?
Okay,
quick question. Andrew, in your presentation, you mentioned that the presentations from this morning were illuminating. I think that was the word that you used. And I'm just thinking, stemming from that and what you saw this morning and what you got out of that, do you think there should be a change in the role for the AA in how they review the FCR, perhaps, or the advice that they give to management in regards to CAT risk management?
I think it would be best to say that, like me, I'm on a journey of learning on this stuff and have been for the last 10 years. I think most AAs would be on a journey. I think most organisations are on a journey. So I think that as all that grows, you'll end up with improved board knowledge of what goes on and what's needed to go on, and understanding the CAT risk, but also better presentation to the board in the FCR of the appointed actuary. So does it really need to change? Probably not. I mean, it comes down to, you know, is the appointed actuary really going to be, as I mentioned, a policeman in this thing, or are they actually going to be a useful advisor? And I think it's much better being a useful advisor. I mean, the fact that I have that sort of police power, as I said, that it's almost the power of veto when it comes to some of the reinsurance stuff. It's more around what's reasonable and what's not reasonable. It's not a black and white that I have to take my number. The one thing I was talking about before, I'd forgotten to mention, of course, we actually do get the reinsurance brokers also modelling required limits, so it's not just my team that comes up with it. But, I'd rather the actuaries be staying advisors rather than being compliance-type people.
Can I just ask a question for context for Andrew and Tim? Like, if we're sitting there talking about the CAT risk on IAG and Suncorp's balance sheet, how much time do you spend on that with board-type discussions relative to having $8 billion of reserves? So if the reserves went horribly wrong, you could do yourself a world of damage that may be bigger than what you could do from a net catastrophe event.
Yeah, well,
me, just in terms of relativities on the balance sheet.
From a reinsurance point of view, it's actually the reinsurance cost, which is obviously a big thing as well. So that's a big P&L hit. But, I mean, the reserves are a big thing.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to think. I would think we're probably very similar between the two. Well, as I said, it's evolving, I think. Tim, you've got a view?
Yeah, in fact, Nick Holt is the CFO of IAG.
Okay, cool.
Yep.
Everyone just
It comes down to, I thought, also what's topical, I think.
I said that one.
Cool. Okay, I'm afraid we are going to have to call it wraps. Apologies for anyone whose questions didn't get asked, but feel free to grab the guys or myself during the break and you can ask those face to face. We'll now take a half hour break and come back for the last session. There we go. Thank you.